Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, one-on-one with Andrew McCarthy, Brat Packer extraordinaire. All those movies you remember, Mannequin, St. Elmo's Fire, Pretty in Pink, Less Than Zero. Oh, man, Weekend at Bernie's, all there, man. So we'll talk to him. First, I'll tell you about Geico. Do you own, do you rent your home? Well, sure you do. And then there's your automotive policy. Now you got to get your bundle working with Geico. Geico makes it easy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around the home. So go to geico.com, take your homeowner's or your renter's insurance, and get your bundle working with your automotive policy. You get a quote and see just how much you could be saving when you get your bundle going at geico.com. That's geico.com.
Do you want to be a part of Adam's next book?
No!
Submit your questions for Ask an Asshole by emailing them to askhole@adamcarolla.com. Ask about any topic you need the Ace Man's advice or answers on. That's askhole@adamcarolla.com.
Andrew McCarthy has joined me. He's got a new book out, a memoir called Brat, an 80s story. It's a revealing look at Andrew's coming-of-age story dealing with innocence, addiction, and masculinity. And here he is to talk about it. Good to see you, Andrew.
You too.
I'm a fan. I grew up watching all your movies and always had a mild obsession with you.
Really? Okay. Do tell.
I don't know. I guess I've probably seen St. Elmo's Fire 145 times. And
really? And I was the guy you identified with.
Yeah, it was weird. I don't even know if I identified with you. I've just sort of found myself studying your character a lot. But also, Less Than Zero, I felt that the same way about, which I announced is like the 80th of all 80s movies. Would you agree?
I would. I mean, that movie is sort of like if the 80s were a party, that's the 2:30 in the morning kind of, it's grinding down and we're just kind of taking another hit to try and keep it going when we know the party's over kind of movie.
I also have a little bit of a connection because the Ringwald family grew up the street from me in North Hollywood.
No way.
Yeah, I had a big crush on Molly's older sister, Beth. And when I met Molly, she was 10 or something. Like, there was no, they lived in a little itty bitty house in North Hollywood, and dad played the piano, and it was like a funky little family. Mom baked all day. It had nothing to do with celebrity at all.
Funny. Yeah, she came. Her father was a musician. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, Bob plays Dixieland.
Oh, does he? You live above a Dixieland bar, but that's another story.
You what?
I lived above a bar that played Dixieland.
When?
Back right around that time, 80. Well, no, right before Weekend of Bernie's, around 87 or so, 88.
So what? Let's talk about your story. How does it begin?
Oh, that's how far back you want to go.
Well, I know something. I know you went to NYU for a couple of years and were kind of asked to leave.
Yeah, I went to NYU to study acting, and I was kicked out after a couple of years. And then right after I was kicked out, a few weeks, a friend of mine called me up and said, look, they're casting a movie looking for someone 18, vulnerable and sensitive. And I was like, dude, that's me. So I went up to the audition when there were 500 other 18 vulnerable and sensitive kids. And I went to another audition, just kept going back and back. And finally they cast me as the lead in this movie with, you know, then I had to fly out and meet Jacqueline Bisset. I was to play Jacqueline Bisset's young lover in a movie called Class. And so I had to fly out to meet her and get approved by her and whatnot. And then
with Rob Lowe, right?
Rob Lowe. Yep.
Yeah, I watched the shit out of all those movies back in the day. So you had, so that was a major movie as your first movie, right? I mean, that was a, you know, it wasn't Gone with the Wind, but it was a major theatrical release. It was in
theaters. Yeah, I mean, it was a real movie back then. You know, it wasn't successful particularly, and it wasn't well reviewed at all, but it was a real movie, yeah, for sure.
And you got that straight out of leaving NYU?
Yeah, I mean, I'd been studying college, and so I got it right out studying acting in college, and I got it right out of right after they kicked me out, and then I was in the movies, and then I didn't work again for a year. So you know, my next job was being the Pepsi boy in a Burger King commercial with Elizabeth Shue, and which is still visible to this day on YouTube. None of our past mistakes and come back to haunt us on YouTube, and. Then I did a movie called Catholic Boys, or Heaven Help Us. It was retitled Heaven Help Us. And then came Satan on Was Fire, and then my career kind of happened.
Was Heaven Help Us Sean Penn?
No.
Am I confused?
It's a movie about a Catholic boys' school in Brooklyn in New York in the 1960s. It was a really good movie. It's probably the best movie I did in the 80s, with Donald Sutherland's in it and John Hurd. And and Mary Stuart Masterson as the girl. And it was a good movie.
So for you... You're out. Why'd they kick you out of NYU film school or acting school?
Well, in the theater program. Well, I didn't go. I was in 3 days a week. I did acting stuff, which I was interested in, went to. And then 2 days a week, I had academic classes, which I just never bothered to go to. So that was that.
But you're a good enough student in high school academically to get to NYU.
I was not a good student in high school academically at all. I just used to smoke a lot of pot and had no interest. And back then, NYU was not a difficult school to get into. And I got into it for the theater program. So it was just, I auditioned and got in. It was the only school I got into. So I went there. But it wasn't sort of, it's become this kind of elite school somehow, but it certainly wasn't in 1980.
Well, yeah, it is funny because you talk to a lot of people that are talented, but don't seem like very good students, like Adam Sandler and a lot of other like young comedians or now middle-aged comedians. And they go, oh, we met at NYU. And I'm like, how the hell did you pass the SATs? But you, at some point, addiction comes into your life?
Yeah. I was all during that time. I was, you know, I guess when I started drinking at the normal drinking age of about 12, but it started to take over my, become a dominant force in my life in my 20s. All the time I was making those Brat Pack movies. Yeah. It was sort of existing. I mean, I always say that I didn't drink because I was in those movies. People always say, oh, you were successful too soon, so you drank. And I'm like, no, I drank because I really loved vodka and I had an affinity for drinking. And that's, I was able to drink better vodka because I was in the movies. But no, I drank because it was like a primary thing. It wasn't a reaction to anything else. So yeah, all through the 80s, and it started to get in the way of my work, late 80s, I'd say. Till then, the first half of the 80s, it was not a factor, really. It sort of gave me a certain Dutch courage and sort of persona a bit, but later on, the way it always does, it sort of turns in on you at that invisible point when you don't know it, and it had a, you know, detrimental effect. Took me several years to realize I had a problem, then several years to do something about it.
How long you been sober?
She in 92.
Wow. You and trying to think the guys who've been sober the longest. Bobcat Goldthwait. I think he got sober when he was like 18 or something like that. I'm always
29.
Yeah. You were 29?
I was 29, yeah. But, you know, lucky in that I was totally played out. It wasn't like I was drinking and I could have pretended that it wasn't an issue. It was just such a dominant force in my life at that point that like very little else could go on at that point. So I couldn't pretend that it was, you know, something I could handle or something. It just took over my life.
I'm sure there's plenty of Brat Pack talk in the book. Can you tell us some of those stories, affairs, fights, fun tidbits?
What's the last bit you said there?
Fun tidbits, anecdotes.
Well, the most Brat Packy story that I know is the night when Rob Lowe, we were doing St. Elmo's Fire, and Rob invited me to go out to dinner with him and his girlfriend and who was Melissa Gilbert at the time, the actress on Little House on the Prairie, and said, we're going to Spago, dude, you want to come? And Spago was, as you probably know, this sort of the premier eatery in Los Angeles at that time. You know, it's like Wolfgang Puck's first restaurant, yeah. I think. Anyway, it was just this hot spot. And so I went, and my dinner, the other person at dinner was Liza Minnelli. And I was like, oh, hi, Liza. Yeah, I'll have a double vodka, please. And then at the end of the evening, Liza kind of said, hey, what do you say we all go to Sammy's? Which I'm now, you know, half of the bag. And I said, yeah, Sammy's love to go to Sammy's. I thought Sammy's was like a club or Studio 54 or something on the West Coast. Let's go to Sammy's. And so we all pile in the car and sort of head up into the hills. And we suddenly realize we are not going to some club. We're at somebody's house. And then we knock on the door and the door swings open and there's Sammy Davis Jr. going, hey, cats, come on in. I'm having a little bash. Join the party. And we hung out at Sammy Davis Jr.'s house and joined the party. And it was kind of this crazy, weird, show-busy Hollywood night. It was kind of great. Sammy was fantastic to us. You know, he was with me just smoking away and I'm smoking, he's smoking and he's making me drinks. And he's like, I got my eye on you. I got my good eye on you and I'm loving what you're doing. Keep it up. I'm like, thanks, Sammy. Can I have another vodka?
I wonder if those days, I mean, I know there's Hollywood parties now, but I don't think there's those Hollywood parties now. Certainly not where everyone's smoking.
I mean, it was a different time for sure. And it was still when that kind of old Hollywood still existed, you know, around the periphery. And they were very kind of welcoming to us in, you know, in a way that there was no kind of resentment, like, who do you young punks think you are? It was just like, yeah, join the club, man. Come on in the family. Which was kind of wondrous and great and exciting. And on one hand, and on the other hand, it seemed utterly mundane and normal. And like, they're just people and you're just sort of having a drink at Sammy's house. But no matter what, it's still Sammy Davis Jr.
I always say the best era was pre-AIDS, mid-Coke. So AIDS didn't exist and Coke was kind of good for you, or certainly wasn't bad for you back then. And it must have been a fun time to have a party.
I remember when someone said to me, when I was first shown cocaine, and someone said, it's like the perfect drug. It has no consequences. Mm-hmm. Okay, give me some. You know, and that is what people kind of, I don't know what, that was sort of the word on the street at that moment. And it was just right around then. It was a little early. That would be early 80s, like very early, late 70s, really that.
But Coke wasn't your weapon of choice. It was vodka.
Not mine. If you had it, I did it. If you had it, I did it because it helped me drink more. But no, I drank because I drank. Yeah.
Do you? And how was your? I think your. I'm trying to think what your parents did. Somebody told me banker.
My mother worked in advertising at a magazine, and my dad sold insurance. And then later, he structured tax shelters and some kind of vague business dealings.
How were they with your incredible Brat Pack fame?
You know, my dad had a hard time because his fortunes were sort of crashing as mine were ascending. So he had a difficult time with that. And that's in the book a bit. I talk a lot about that because it was such a dominant force of, you know, there were three things that happened to me in the 80s. One was I was in the movies and became successful. One was I drank a lot. The third was I had a very conflicted, difficult relationship with my father. And they're all sort of intertwined, you know. And when I started making money, my father started needing money desperately. And so it turned into a whole dynamic that was pretty unfortunate. So my mom was always like, oh, it's wonderful, dear. I'm glad you're doing what you want to do. But my dad had a difficult time with it.
Were your parents together at the time?
No, they split up just as I went to college. They'd split up. My dad, you know, he was having a tough time.
Was it weird being kind of grouped in, like the Brat Pack? Like, we had decided collectively as a society that this group of actors must be put together or must be labeled something. And we don't really do that anymore. I just feel like this guy, I mean, it's sort of the antithesis of being an actor, not really being an individual in the sense that you get labeled as a group.
And that's a really good point. I never heard it put like that. It is exactly the antithesis of what you want as an actor. Particularly, you don't want to be called a brat. You don't want to be
right.
You don't want to be labeled anything, because the minute you're labeled anything, people stop examining it, and it's just what that is. You're that, and that's the end of it. The conversation's over about you, and that is not helpful to an actor. Certainly, it's not helpful to a human. And although we all do it, and it certainly wasn't helpful when So I recoiled from the phrase at first. I thought it was awful. And it was a very pejorative kind of negative term in the media and in sort of around show business. It was very kind of stigmatizing. I think the public always kind of thought of it as this kind of cruel, affectionate term, like we were the ultimate in-group, and they, you know, aspired to that. It took me a long time to kind of come around to their way of thinking that it was a positive thing and not this negative thing to be saddled with. But I certainly didn't appreciate it when it happened. I mean, it came from this magazine article that was really, you know, quite a nasty article. So
for you, do you feel, and by the way, I should just tell the listeners, because I'm kind of looking down the list here, Emilio Estevez was a Brat Packer, though I thought of him as sort of half a Brat Packer. Anthony Michael Hall, Rob Lowe was squarely in there, Demi Moore, Judd Nelson, of course, Molly Ringwald, Ally Sheedy. Do you feel then like you almost got stereotyped from that era, from those people, from that title, from that label?
For a long time, sure. I don't know if stereotyped is the word so much, but certainly, you know, branded, and that's what you were, you know, and that's what we were in, you know, and so it preceded anything I did. If I walked in, it was my introduction to you, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, I didn't care for it. You know, I just thought it was, like I said, negative and sort of pejorative and kind of nasty. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. That's not, and what I didn't like about it, it just felt like I wasn't seen, you know?
Right.
And then, but again, you know, the public was having a different response to that. And, you know, I could have made the same movies in the 80s that I made. And if the Brat Pack term didn't exist, we probably wouldn't be talking now. Because it came over time, certainly, to represent this era in pop culture and become this iconically affectionate phrase that it has now become. But it also is sort of like a soup that all the different, it's more than the sum of its ingredients in a certain way. So the Brat Pack has come to mean this thing. And the Brat Pack now, to my estimation, from what I've gleaned over all these decades of it, is that it's sort of like, it's not so much the movies anymore. It's the people. Recall when you say Brat Pack to a certain generation of person, it's them recalling their youth. Mm-hmm. It's not even recalling me in movies or the movies themselves. It's recalling them where they were when those movies were happening. And all those people were at that moment in life when they were just cusping and stepping out into the world and just sort of their future was like this blank slate to be written on. And that's a thrilling, exciting time in life, you know? And that's what I have come over the years to. I've become like this avatar of people's youth in a certain way.
I could remember, and by the way, I was at the Pretty in Pink premiere back in mid-later 80s. I don't know, 85, 86.
I'm trying to
think. But did you go to the Pretty in Pink premiere out here in Los Angeles?
I did at the Man Chinese. Yeah, I did.
Man's Chinese.
And when I walked out and it started, when the credits rolled, I got up and left.
Oh, you did?
I did. I walked across the street to Hamburger Hamlet and got drunk.
Did you go to the after party?
Yeah, I did at the Palace. Yeah, I was there. Are you sure?
I'm so glad you confirmed that, because I was friendly enough with Molly and the Ringwalds to go to that Palace after party after Pretty in Pink. I here's a detail from that night that I'll never forget. Quite a few, actually, but Molly had her wisdom teeth pulled.
Yeah.
I'm so glad someone can substantiate this story. She had her wisdom teeth pulled like the day before.
Dude, that's the first line of my book, is Molly was there, but her wisdom teeth had been pulled. It's the first line of the book.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, don't expect to go on anyone else's podcast and have that story substantiated, because she sat right behind me at the Grauman's Chinese Theater, and I remember looking at her face, and it was all chipmunky, like it was all swollen. And I remember thinking, this is your movie premiere. Why didn't you get the wisdom teeth pulled on the next following week, Friday? Yeah. I could never figure that. She had probably had too much cotton in her mouth to answer me clearly. But I do remember going to the Palace and going to the after party and getting shit-faced on vodka. I didn't really have a drinking problem, but my thing back then was free booze. I'm going to drink enough for 10 people.
Yeah, and I was there's footage of that exists again on YouTube of, how do I say, Faye, the guy, the lead singer from the Tubes,
yes,
Fee Waybill or something like this,
and Phoebe or something. Wade Weibel or something. Yeah.
Fee Weibel.
Like the tubes. Yeah.
Yeah. He was interviewing people for MTV and he got me on camera interviewing me. And I'm just smoking and I'm just clearly just so drunk. It's like you can't imagine how a publicist in this day and age, they would just never let that happen. First, they'd grab the cigarette and then they'd see me sort of swaying and they go, oh, you're not going to go talking on TV now.
Was that out front of the palace?
That was inside in the, during the party with the sort of, you know, the lights flashing and that 80s kind of smoke filling the place. And yeah.
God, I've never, it's funny. I've always, I talked about this story because I had my own sort of alcohol induced situation that night as well. I had built up this sort of hot rod Z car. Always was into cars, never had any money, but this was just a big, loud, sort of, just a loud race car that I'd built in my apartment garage. And I was there with a friend of mine, and I had labeled him the designated driver for the night, and I was just drinking my ass off because free booze, and he's my designated driver. And another detail you may recall from that night is it started raining really hard at a certain point. You may have been in the bag by then.
Yeah, that you've got me there.
It started pouring, and I was the last guy left at the palace because I was I was looking for my friend. My friend had hooked up with a chick and left. Never said a word to me. And I found myself, it's a big place with like multiple stories and levels. I found myself walking around everywhere looking for my buddy who was going to drive me home. And I was completely obliterated. And at some point it was clear it was time to leave. I was the last one there. And I staggered out and it was driving rain. And I walked up the hill because it was like on Franklin or something. There was that hill that was behind it, and I had parked my car in like a bank parking lot at the top of the hill, and it was a driving rainstorm, and I walked up there and I saw my car parked in the parking lot, and the only other car in the parking lot was an LAPD cruiser parked directly next to my car with no context at all. Just windows were like fogged up, couldn't see if anyone was in there, lights off. Only two cars in the parking lot. I had no umbrella or anything. I was just standing in a rainstorm staring at this car. And I didn't know what to do. So I just got into my car, but I just sat there. I was too scared to fire it up because I thought as soon as I fired it up, the cops are going to hit the rollers and they were waiting for me. And I just sat in there for an hour doing nothing, scared to death. And eventually I just started it up, drove home, and threw up in the bathtub that night. That's, but I'm glad you remember that Molly Ringwald had her wisdom teeth removed a couple days earlier. Oh, we have, I think we have that clip with Fee from the tube.
Oh, no, yeah, there it is.
And you, and oh, is that and Spader there?
James Spader there, yeah.
Oh my God, can we play that?
No, please don't.
Those are just two of the guys chasing Molly in Pretty in Pink. And to put it simply, one's the good guy and one's not so good guy. And I'm here with both of them now, Andrew McCarthy and James Spader. James is the not so good guy. Was it fun?
I don't know about that.
Well, I thought you were.
Right.
Was it fun playing the bad guy?
It's always fun playing the bad guy.
I really hated you in the film. I mean, I loved your acting, but you convinced me, and
there's
I really
a drink
thought
that you could pour all over me if you wanted.
You just.
All right, I won't torture. I won't torture Andrew anymore. That's insane.
You get the idea, though.
It's insane that exists. And it's also insane that at that very moment, I was wandering around that same place drinking a Greyhound, getting shit-faced. I also remember that Barbara Bach, Daisy Duke from the Dukes of Hazzard, was there.
That's big night.
It was a
big night.
It was a big that damn night. All right, we'll get more into the book in a second. I just want to hit Caldera. Caldera Lab, dry skin, acne scars, wrinkles, or just want healthier skin. This is the product I use, The Good by Caldera Lab. Non toxic natural serum made from 100% plants, named by GQ the best natural face serum for men, for all guys and all skin types. Great with a beard, great with a bald head, or you try it on your scalp as well. Keeps it shiny and moisturized. Caldera Lab believes you shouldn't have to decide between clean, sustainable ingredients and real results. Simply apply to dry skin. And Bob's your uncle. This stuff works like magic. Try it 100% risk-free. If you don't love it, they'll refund you in full. Right, Dawson?
Special offer for the Adam Carolla Show audience. 20% off your first Caldera Lab purchase of the good. Go to calderalab.com/Adam. CalderaLab.com. Or use discount code Adam at checkout.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Back to talk a little more to Andrew McCarthy right after this. Hey, Geico, do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there. Owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle? Bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.
You will get Ace Man's favorites. You will get awesome booze for $25 shipped to you. You better believe it. You can get Adam's monthly nut. You should get Adam's monthly nut. You should get Adam's monthly nut. There's some real cool crap. You know that you want that.
You heard Dick. A new month of Adam's Monthly Nut hath come. This month features four Man Show coasters made to remind you to respect wood and to remember one of the greatest television shows of all time. A book of booze-themed Mad Libs so you can spend your downtime without scrolling on your phone. A pack of dude wipes to rid yourself of Fromunda. A tin of Drive Coffee Energy to keep you as alert as a goddamn Navy SEAL. And of course, a bottle of your choice. Head to CorollaDrinks.com for 1 month or keep the shipments coming.
Back with Andrew McCarthy, Brat, an 80s story. It's available now on Amazon. I am so glad we stumbled into this Pretty in Pink thing. Also, I'm from North Hollywood. I'm from the San Fernando Valley. So I used to just watch St. Elmo's Fire and go, what is this life over here where you have like brick buildings with ivy on the side of them and seasons? And like it all seemed bizarre to me coming from North Hollywood. Any recollections from St. Elmo's Fire?
Well, I mean, we shot most of that at the back lot in North Hollywood. We were only a couple weeks in D.C. Most of it, like a bar and everything, were all built on the soundstage. Yeah.
Did you film that at Radford Studios out here?
No, we filmed it at Warner Brothers.
Oh, man. So you filmed that thing like 4 miles from where I was living, wondering what this crazy land would be like to live in?
Yeah, I mean, that was a lot of fun most of the time, that movie. You know, I just felt like I was, for the first time, ready to go. You know, I felt like I knew I was the right guy in the right part at the right time. And I knew, you know, and I knew it. And I had a ball. And I knew where I fit in that group, sort of just off to the side of it, and sort of had my little opportunities to chime in and score. And I really enjoyed that movie.
I know you're doing directing now, Orange is the New Black and Blacklist and Gossip Girl, amongst others. Is that how much acting versus directing versus writing are you into now?
Well, I mean, my day job for the last 10 years has been travel writing for a while there. And then in the last decade, mostly I have been directing television. Which I enjoy doing. You know, it's an interesting job, and at the end of the day, I think it's ultimately very much a job, but as opposed to a vocation, you know, directing television. But I like it. You know, I have all the actor neuroses that there are, so I understand all that about the actors. So I enjoy the television directing. Although I started acting again recently, just in some shows that I direct, and I do this show called Good Girls sometimes, and I'm acting a bit on that, which is really fun. I'm surprised how much I've enjoyed sort of acting again. I hadn't done it in a number of years, and to sort of be able to just sort of step in and do it without the anxiety it used to cause me was I like it a lot, you know.
We kind of just skim past the travel and the writing, and I know you're an editor at large at National Geographic Travel Magazine. Can we talk a little about that?
Yeah, I mean, that sort of saved my life. I got into that about, you know, early, about 16, 17 years ago. I started travel writing sort of accidentally. And then it, right as my acting sort of was fizzling inside me, I'd lost a lot of interest in it and wasn't doing the kind of things that I would really want to be doing. So it was sort of a reinvigoration of my sort of creative life, for lack of a better word. And so I've just been travel writing and which is a great job. And I mean, it's certainly downwardly mobile from in the movies, but it's been a lot of fun, and I love it. I'm a big believer in travel. I think travel changes people and changes people's lives. I'm not talking about vacations particularly, but I'm talking about, you know, there's that Mark Twain line, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, you know, and I think that's true. I think travel just changes people. So anyway, I got into that, and then I stumbled into directing, and then that sort of took off. And travel writing is a great thing. It doesn't put three kids through private school. So the television directing is who've taken
well,
on its own.
You know, the thing about, I had this sort of bizarre thought about travel as I was driving into work today, because I know the kind of travel you're talking about is a little more interesting and probably more exotic, but I was just thinking as I was driving in, just behind a bunch of cars on the freeway, I went all the towns I've been in and all the shows I've done all over the country. I was just sort of thinking about all the places I've been just here in this country, just mostly doing shows. And I just thought right now someone's sitting in that town and they're behind some car and they're basically having the same experience I'm having here. But when you're here and you never leave here, you don't really know that exists. You don't know. I mean, you understand intellectually people are somewhere and they have a house and they have a car and they have a commute and they have work or whatever. And when you start getting into an international way, and I think this is kind of what you're speaking to, it kind of opens you up. You realize all this stuff is going on all day, every day, and you're kind of pretending like it's only going on within a 10-foot radius of you.
Yeah, exactly. But that's really true. And I think that's to be able to sit in your car and kind of go, oh, that guy in Kansas, he's probably doing the same thing. To be able to do that and actually own that on experiential levels, that changes who you are. And that's a better person than somebody who's never left LA and is sitting there with only that perspective on the world. You know what I mean? And that's made you, you know, that's adds a lot to who you are as a human, you know, and even just observing it on that sort of level. You know, I look in places in the world and I go, oh, my God, they're still doing that. I bet they're still doing that kind of chasing that elephant thing like every day. It wasn't just the day I was there. They do that. That's what they do every day while I'm doing my mundane life. And it's nice to know the world's out there happening. You know, and most of the world is very different than we've been told to fear a lot of the world and all that. And it's just not the case. Not my experience anyway.
You stay in touch with any of the old cohorts?
You know, I didn't for a number of years. And then, you know, as I've grown to sort of embrace the old Brat Pack, I was on, I talked to Rob Lowe last week. I hadn't talked to Rob in a decade. And I was doing his podcast actually. And then it was great to talk to him. It was great. It was sort of, you know, we're getting so old that there's something about those moments of youth. And, you know, a group of us shared something that very few people shared. And so to sort of connect over that's kind of cool. And, you know, I see Molly and talk to Molly not infrequently because she's here in New York. And I was just texting with John Pryor the other day. So, I mean, I do somewhat, yeah. And I think I'm much more affectionate toward the whole idea of it than I used to be for years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it works that way in many facets of show business and then beyond, where you sort of you get saddled with some sort of label, you fight against it, then you reject it, maybe pretend it didn't exist for some time. And then at some point you get a little time, a little perspective, and you realize that you're kind of proud of it. Like, that's an accomplishment. That's pretty.
Exactly. You know, and
that's
exactly my experience. Exactly my experience. And then just sort of owning it and realizing it actually meant a lot to certain people. And they like want people come up to me for a long time. People come up to me and I was always like, oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And go away. And to finally go be able to just sort of embrace that and let them, they want to share with me that it meant something to them. And to be able to receive that was a kind of a maturity or something that I didn't particularly have, or an openness that I wasn't willing to have. And as I've started to become more willing to do that, that's made my life richer, you know, and that took me a while to do. And like that, those movies meant something to people. And that's cool.
John Cryer used to be my neighbor when I lived in Hollywood land.
Dude, you have a Pretty in Pink 6 degrees like going on.
I know. And he lived right across the street with his then wife, a pretty blonde, but I don't think it lasted very long. And Rob did my podcast about a year ago, and I just find that guy to be a great spirit, Rob Lowe.
Rob's fantastic. You know, he stays in the place of delight, you know, and he's sneaky smart, and he just stays in a really kind of good place with it all and skates through in a delightful kind of way, you know. And he always, as a kid, he was that way, and it's sort of, he's settled into it in a great, great way.
Do you have thoughts about, like, I always thought, again, going so far back with Molly Ringwald, and I think she's a real talent, and I feel that way about yourself as well. I feel like there's still some movie or some project or something out there that would be a defining a 2.0 version. Like, you know, it's a sort of a Tarantino cast you in a role for his next film or something like that. Do you think about that? Do you have aspirations of that? Are you comfortable where you're at now? Or do you think, I'm going to write a movie or I'm going to star in this? Like, do you have thoughts about that?
Well, I don't live with it on I think one of the reasons I was able to sort of transform my feelings about the Brat Pack and write the book about it was because I feel so safely distant from it. Like I'm kind of okay with what's going on in my life now, so that I can sort of see that with clarity. But there are times when I kind of go, I wonder if there's one more there, you know. I haven't missed acting until I just started doing it again, like I said. And I thought, that was something, you know, I'll always be an actor. That's what I, it's like that joke of like the two fish pass each other in the water, and one says, hey, ain't the water fine today? And the other fish says, what water?
Right.
I mean, that's what I am. So do I think that occasionally? And sometimes I think that. Like, I wonder if there's one more little pop there. Yeah.
When you wrote the book, obviously you're telling a lot of old stories from back when that involve a lot of these people we were talking about. Did you have to consider that? Did you have to vet it with them? Did you have to run it by them?
Well, I mean, mostly what I was writing was about my sort of internal experience of it. I wasn't sort of telling tales and stuff. But, I mean, I did send stuff Molly was in. I said that's to Molly, see if she was okay with that. And Jacqueline Bisset's in the book for her. Because when I first came to L.A., after the movie I did with her, I went and lived at her house with her. I was her guest at her house for a while. And so I wrote about that fairly extensively. So I sent it to her and asked her if she was okay. So I'd say there were half of it, you know, sent to my mother, see if she was okay. And that was the main one. And then, there were several people I sent things to, because it's not that kind of book. I'm not looking to trash anybody. And that wasn't my experience at the time either. I was just trying to figure stuff out. And in the book, I was trying to piece together what was going on inside me at that time. And so, yes, certain lots of these people were all in it and reflected in it, but it wasn't about them per se. It's not tales about other people particularly.
If you went and lived at Jacqueline Bisset's house, you must have had an insane crush on her.
Oh my God.
I don't think it would be possible to not lust after a 34-year-old Jacqueline Bisset, who's one of the most beautiful women ever.
I was 19. She was 38. She was living with Alexander Gudinov at the time, this Russian ballet star defector. So they were probably the most beautiful couple on the planet. And there was little Andy in the back guest bedroom. And it was just like this crazy time that there'd be these dinner parties. And there's Louis Malin and Candace Bergen. Okay, yeah, pass the salt, please, Candace. And, you know, and there's Andy. And it was crazy, wonderful. I mean, they were so kind and welcoming to me. Yeah, but I certainly was smitten.
Yeah, for those who want to confirm what we're talking about, you should see the just watch the trailer for the movie The Deep, and I think you'll understand what we're talking about. We're talking about Jacqueline Bisset at like the height of her powers. So she's an amazing, amazing looking person, and had a great accent, right?
She's good. Everything. It just all worked, you know.
And did you? You were like staying with them just because you were working out here in L.A.?
Yeah, I'd worked on the movie with Jack, and I play her young lover in this movie. And then as the movie's ending, she says, Andrew, what are you doing after the film? And I said, well, I got to go to L.A. to get an agent, because I didn't have an agent. I just, you know, stumbled in the movie. Like,
oh, that was your first film, right?
Yeah. And so she said, where are you staying? And I said, I don't know. She goes, well, stay with me. I'm like, okay. And so there I was, staying in the back bedroom up in the hills. And I was there for a while. Jack used to drive me sometimes. I would take the bus to auditions because I was too young to rent a car. So I'd take a bus, or if Jack was free, she would drive me to my auditions in her sort of Cadillac convertible. And, you know, she'd wait outside while I went into audition.
Where's Jacqueline Bisset now? I haven't seen her in a while.
I think she's still in the same house.
Really? Wow. Mm. What a bizarre, what an incredible time.
I should have quit show business right then. That was sort of the height of it.
I look at thinking of Less Than Zero, but Robert Downey Jr. is such an amazing talent. Did you catch that early with him?
Well, yeah. I mean, that was sort of a given. But I mean, when we were doing Less Than Zero, I mean, he was, you know, which is all public knowledge, that he was a disaster. He was a mess. He was full blown into his, you know, crisis. And there was a lot of real life on the screen there in that movie. And so it was kind of terrifying. Certainly. And we were all doing our things, but Bobby was in a league of his own there.
Yeah. It's another one of those guys that's just so genuinely nice. He's almost
such a lovely guy. You know, even when he was going through all that stuff, everybody would be like, oh God, I hope he gets it together. Whereas so many times people just like, they don't feel that way. You know, and for whatever reason, I was a lovely, sweet, sensitive guy, and everyone's happy that he came out the other side and became America's favorite superhero, you know?
The book, it's Brat, an 80s story. It's available now on Amazon, and it's a revealing look at Andrew's coming-of-age story, dealing with innocence, addiction, and masculinity. Well, if you get out to L.A., you can come stay in my guest house.
Thanks, Dave.
And I'm so glad you remember that Pretty in Pink premiere party. But I'm sad that you went across the street to the Hamburger Hamlet and drank during the whole movie. But you showed up at the after party, and that's the important part.
I don't think I've ever actually sat through the entire movie of it.
Oh, really?
I don't think so.
What are you that way with all your movies, or was it just that one?
Yeah, pretty much. No, pretty much. I mean, there were 1,000 people there. I was just nervous and scared, and so I just said, I got to go. But it's not. I like the working part of it. I don't particularly love sitting down and watching them that much.
Well, it was good to talk to you, my friend, and I hope we'll get to see you here soon.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Andrew McCarthy, everybody. All right, let me tell you about LifeLock. Cyber criminals target job seekers with fake postings designed to trick people into revealing their personal information and social security number. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives every day. We put our info at risk on the internet. In an instant, cyber criminals could harm your finances and your credit. Good thing there's LifeLock. LifeLock helps detect a wide range of identity threats like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If they detect your information has potentially been compromised, they'll send you an alert and you'll have access to a dedicated restoration specialists. It's LifeLock. Right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but you can keep what's yours yours with LifeLock by Norton. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
Hey, Max Badup, let's find more of that Phoebe Waybill.
Oh, the whole thing's up on YouTube. It's like an hour long.
Really?
Yeah, I'll send you the link. You're going to want to watch that. I was looking to see if I could even find you in the background. I'm like scrubbing through it.
So funny. I've been telling that stupid Molly Ringwald wisdom tooth story for 40 years, and everyone just looks at me like, I don't remember that. But yeah. It's funny that he had a keen, I guess it's in the book. I haven't seen the book yet.
Yeah, validation must be nice.
Validation, finally, everybody. All right. Last but not least, 15 seconds for Hyundai Tucson. Every inch of the all-new Tucson's been completely reimagined, resulting in an SUV loaded with innovation. It is a beautiful piece. Go to Hyundai.com. All right, Giannis Pappas is going to join us. Comedian will join us tomorrow. And Jam in the Van this Saturday. Come on out. Everyone's playing, and a whole gang will be there. Go to AdamCarolla.com for all the live shows. And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Andrew McCarthy, Gina Grad, and Bald Brian saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Check out Gina Grad with Teresa Strasser on the podcast Easy Listening and Bald Brian on the Film Vault. And a bunch of us on the water cooler. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Please do. And get tickets for this Saturday's Jam in the Van at AdamCarolla.com.